You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Well, good evening. Whoa, is that too loud? No. Who knew?
There are official people here in charge of volume. There he is. There's the volume.
And there's another person in charge of quality. So we have both things covered. Okay, then. My name is Jonathan Zittrain, and I am so pleased to be in conversation tonight with Bruce Schneier. Bruce is a kind of a really good person to introduce in the sense that he's extremely well known, but not for trite reasons. It's actually hard to put a bumper sticker on Bruce and not simply because he's security conscious. I think the closest thing would be he's extremely well known for his attitudes and common sense around TSA. And I believe you actually coined the phrase security theater.
Security theater is mine.
And that's a great phrase, and you can't help but enjoy every episode of Security Theater as you encounter it now on the way. And it's also been really interesting to see Bruce's evolution from somebody writing a canonical text in applied cryptography, kind of has the technical chops, then really thinking more systemically, including human factors, about security. And again, in his explanations, being lucid but not reducing in ways that immediately make good guys and bad guys and sort of simplistic slogans, and yet still, again, popular enough that I believe you are an internet meme, are you not?
Oddly enough, yes.
There is an internet meme about
you look Bruce up Bruce Schneier facts. I have nothing to do with them.
Exactly.
But just not now.
Well, it's too late.
Don't you guys put these rooms in Faraday cages?
I don't. That would be an MIT thing to do,
okay.
And yet not, because then they would hack the Faraday cage. But we just rely on law to keep people honest, and it doesn't work. So that's a deeper problem than the ones we're going probably to talk about tonight. The last time Bruce and I shared a stage, I believe it was 2010, and it was for the Intelligence Squared debate, resolved the cyber war threat has been greatly exaggerated.
Grossly exaggerated.
Grossly exaggerated.
It was kind of interesting. It was myself and Mark Rotenberg on one side. We were the sides of, yes, it's grossly exaggerated. On the other side was Mike McConnell, used to run the NSA, now a big exec at Booz Allen Hamilton, one of the people who grossly exaggerate cyber war for a living. And you.
It seems only fitting to be on that side of the debate.
And I actually thought it pretty easy. I would present a list of gross exaggerations, we'd all vote, and then we'd go home. It was more complicated, and I actually lost that debate. It really surprised me. But at the end of the hour and a half or something, the vote was they polled the audience in the beginning and polled the audience at the end. So you could think about how to game the system. Let's assume people didn't. More people are convinced that cyber was a real threat than was grossly exaggerated. And it really was thinking about that loss that really got me to understand the cyber war debate, you know, why we lost. And a lot of it was definitional. We spent most of the time arguing on the definition of cyber war. And I think that is, in a lot of ways, the policy problem today. That we don't know when cyber war starts, when it ends, what it looks like when it's going on. And it's not just, you know, the debaters or researchers. It's, you know, it's policy people don't have a good definitions. So it's real hard to discuss whether the threat is exaggerated unless you know what the is. And I'm going to go on a little bit. It used to be in the real world, you would judge the threat by the weaponry. Right? When you saw a tank driving at you, you knew it was war because only governments could afford tanks. Right? The problem in cyberspace is everyone's using the same weaponry. Right? Everyone's using DDoS attacks. Everyone's using exploits. Everyone's using exfiltration. They're all doing the same things. You can't look at the weaponry. You can't look at the tactics and figure out who you're fighting. And this is a problem, right? Because when you're being attacked in cyberspace, you're being attacked in general, there are a lot of people you can call. Right? You can call the police. You can call the military. You can call Homeland Security. You can call your lawyers. I guess we're here. Right? And the regime in which your defense operates depends on exactly two things: who's attacking you and why. And when you're attacked in cyberspace, the exact two things you don't know are who's attacking you and why. So we're seeing the military use a very expansive definition because they want to, capture the whole, the whole gamut of the attacks. Where I argue very strongly for a much narrower definition. And that is why I lost that debate. You've never heard that.
Well,
you think it's because you debated better than I did.
No.
But in fact, you didn't.
I was...
Ha-ha.
I was going to say you lost because we hacked the vote, thereby proving our side.
Well, more of McConnell's friends were in the audience.
Yes.
And right, and if, of course, if they voted no to start, but I assume they played fair.
Indeed. Well, this isn't a debate in the sense that we often, I think, share more views than we disagree upon. And it's also not a debate in the sense that I think we're wanting to structure this conversation and the one that we'll put out to the entire room before too long as thinking aloud more than advancing some particular view and asking people to hammer upon it. This really is, especially given the collective brain trust I already see in this room, this is like a group study exercise more than it is a delivery of an academic paper or a thesis that we're then supposed to beat up upon. By way of framing, though, I think it is interesting, first, just from the remarks as you were getting into substance, to already hear you using words like weapon, which already seems to me to be conceding a big part of the frame of the debate, something that you see the likes of Anonymous, I think, ironically, deploying when they talk about the low-orbit ion cannon, which is, I think, life imitating art, imitating art, imitating life, because the low-orbit ion cannon is itself not a real cannon. I think also I hope we'll get a chance to talk about what I perceive at least as a trajectory in your own thinking from the beyond fear phase, which captured a lot of your thinking about, look, it's complicated, it's not like there aren't real threats, but we're often focused on exactly the wrong stuff to our detriment, hence let's get beyond fear, to what I think is shaping up to be maybe your next book, which you haven't named it yet, but as best I can tell, the title might be Afraid, Be Very Afraid. And it's about asymmetric threats, very generally from technology, not even limited to cyber. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm characterizing this because he'll feel free to correct my characterization in a moment. But I know you have a lot of worries about the asymmetries between offense and defense and the prospect that as time goes on, our normal ways of handling things, and including normal is how reasonable, technically oriented people would handle them, may fall short and thereby leave us with a real dilemma about how to secure ourselves. That's at least, I think,
right,
where you're at on the current puzzle. We could start there and work back, or start at the beginning and work forward.
Well, that's a piece of it. And it is a small piece, but it's something I've been wondering about for a while. And I wrote it down, and some of the comments I got was, wow, you must have had a really bad day. I mean, very generally, we accept a certain amount of bad action in society, right? The price of freedom is the possibility of crime. We recognize that. That in order to be a free society, we deliberately limit what the police can do. We do a bunch of things to make crime possible. And there's a crime rate that we accept. Right? The murder rate is not zero, and we wouldn't want it to be zero. There's a whole lot of reasons why that would be bad. And we have some natural...
We might want it to be zero, but we realize that what it would take to make it so would make us not the society we want to be.
We wouldn't want the ill effects, right?
Yeah.
We'd be too many false arrests. There'd be a whole lot of reasons why you wouldn't want that. So
yeah.
And if you think about this, the amount of damage a bad actor can do is vaguely a function of technology. I mean, that terrorists can kill X people as a function of technology, 1, 10, 100, 1,000, as their weaponry gets better. A bank robber can steal more money or steal more accounts. As the amount of damage an individual bad actor can do increases, the fewer bad actors we're willing to tolerate, right? If assuming that effect is constant. I mean, we want a murder rate of X. If the murderers murder 10 times as many people as before, then we need 1/10 of them to keep that number. I mean, this is very hand-wavy and vague. Which is
this just in, Bruce will never be running for elective office, ever.
Oh, God, no.
In fact, appointed office is now seriously in question.
Whole lot of reasons for that. So as...
It'll be legalized soon.
As the amount of damage increases, the number of bad actors we're willing to tolerate decreases. And in theory, you can imagine it get to the point where even one is bad. Even one is too much. Right? This is the weapons of mass destruction debate. Right? The terrorists can do so much frickin' damage that we must rewrite all of our laws to make sure we catch them before they do their bad thing. Right? No more after-the-fact detection and response that works for murder and a lot of other crimes. I mean, this must be predictive policing. This must be arresting people on conspiracy. I mean, all of those reasons why you have these very invasive investigative tools.
Which is to say, what used to be a spectrum on a dial of enforcement to try to scale to the nature of the problem becomes a binary choice between doom from terrorist or doom from police state.
Kind of. You know, so my worry is now...
Doing my best on the bumper sticker.
No, that's
here.
Good. And eventually I'll do a bumper sticker because I like them too. Eventually you get to the point where technology becomes so great, and I'm wondering this is like now a general rule of civilization we could apply around the galaxy. If there comes a point in any species' technological advancement where the amount of damage one lone actor can do is so devastating that it destroys society. Now, if that's the case, and I'm postulating that destroying is easier than preventing destruction, there will be a window in technological advancement where one lone actor or a group of lone actors can destroy society. So now, what is the chance that society can get beyond that? I'm not sure I'm optimistic about the chances. You know, we tend to run a pretty wide tail bell curve around our species. So that's, in general, the worry. Now, what does that mean? I'm not sure. Is it true? I mean, a lot of things I wrote this to see if people can refute that well. Right? Maybe, in the last book, I spent a whole chapter arguing on this notion that... the attackers have an inherent advantage because they're a first mover. They're a first mover and they can react quicker. What's an example? Someone invents the motor car and the police say, what a great idea, and they have a committee to study the use of a car. They produce an RFP. They get bids. They buy a car. They have a training program. They figure out how to use it. Meanwhile, the bank robber says, oh, look, new getaway vehicle. Right? And we saw this on the internet, right? You know, as soon as the internet appears, you suddenly have this new breed of cyber criminal who like emerges organically and figures out how to commit crime on the internet. Meanwhile, the police, who've been trained on Agatha Christie novels, it took them, 10 years to figure out how to defend. And I'll argue in general there will be this temporal gap as society increases, I mean, as technology increases, where the bad actors, the lone actors, the fringe actors are more agile.
It is interesting, though. Your story is basically good cops and bad robbers are on a similar baseline, and then the robbers adopt enabling technology sooner. It may also be a little bit the good cops or just cops are
right.
Very well resourced, use that to have an advantage that they might not have in sheer numbers, but use the technology to leverage it. I can listen in on a conversation
right.
That you can't, and then the technology has a democratizing effect that levels the playing field but makes it so that the cops no longer have the multiplier they were I guess either way, it's
outcome. I don't know. I mean, I have other thoughts where we're seeing power use technologies to effects that we didn't imagine before. And there are exceptions to this. Fingerprint technology is an easy exception, right? This is a technology that benefited the police and didn't benefit the criminals at all. Or really the thing that advanced policing most probably in the last 1,000 years is the invention of the radio. That fundamentally changed the way police work works. Because no longer was a policeman a lone actor in the community. He was able to radio for backup, and that just changed everything. Right, you can argue that, and I think this is also true, while the fringe actors are more nimble, the state actors, the powerful actors, have a greater multiplier. Right, can make use of technology not faster, but once they figure it out, to greater effect. Right, so and we're seeing that now in the government of Syria using Facebook to spy on people, or using internet technologies for surveillance, whereas 5 years ago, the only people using them effectively were the dissidents. And now it's not clear where the new balance is.
Well, so I want to just bookmark a little bit as we go, because we can put a few ideas on the table and then have a larger conversation. So one idea on the table is what I kind of called be very afraid. Another way of describing it is asymmetry between offense and defense.
And I'm an inherent optimist, so it's weird to sort of have this dystopian essay under my belt.
Well, especially because it's not just dystopian. It runs in a very different flow from a lot of your other work, mm-hmm. such as your work on digital feudalism. There's a loaded term for you, in which you worry a lot about centralization of certain technological functionalities, either with private actors, the Googles and Apples or whoever of the world, or public authorities, the Syrias of right. the world. And that's the kind of thing for which it's exactly those folks that would want to do that and encourage that centralization that would benefit from fanning the fears of the first topic. You know, if you want
right.
to be protected from these asymmetries, come shelter your website under Amazon Web Services. Come do your email through Gmail and let us filter your spam and malware. And right. By the way, I think Bruce and I may be the only people in the room still using Eudora. Any other Eudora users?
I met a Pine user.
I wasn't my email client is older than yours challenge. I knew there'd be Pine users. I was just, there's that one moment in history that we both tend to.
It's going to be sad when we have to give up Eudora because nothing else is like it.
I keep clicking on as many banner ads as possible just to keep it afloat. But anyway, a second cluster of thinking that you have recently is around mm-hmm. this sort of digital fuse. And I want to just give you a little space to kind of map that out and say welcome to the club of people worrying about this.
Actually, to me, this does echo the stuff that was in your book, which I actually had to re-look at after forgetting it and re-remembering it.
That's a blurb worth putting on the back. The book's so nice, I read it twice after I forgot it the first time.
It's actually not that bad. So,
the book or the blurb?
The blurb.
Okay,
the blurb.
Good.
I've been thinking a lot about power, power and power asymmetry. And I see increasingly we're living in a computing world that I liken to feudalism. Right, the idea being if you pledge your allegiance to Apple and give them your email and your calendar and your address book and your photographs, your life is easy. Right, and they, in turn, I guess they promise to protect you. Right, you can pledge your allegiance to Google. A lot of us pledge some of our allegiance to Facebook, to Amazon. I mean, all of these companies that are increasingly controlling our data, right, as we move them onto these platforms, and controlling our end-user devices. Right, the era of general-purpose computing seems to be fading. Right, Apple controls what is allowed to be on your iPhone and iPad. Right, Amazon controls what could be in your Kindle, and last year they forcibly removed the book. It happened to be 1984, which was you couldn't write that stuff.
You couldn't write that stuff.
And I mean, I like the feudal metaphor because in a lot of ways we are pawns. So, for example, I found this out recently, that while I can, that Google and Apple are two feudal lords fighting, and one of the effects is that I can run Google Maps on my iPhone, but not my iPad. Google and Facebook are fighting, and one of the effects is that Google Reader is disappearing. Right? I mean, these things are happening. These companies are, they're protecting us, but they're also selling us. They're using us. And it is very much, and I mean, feudal is kind of half history and half Game of Thrones here. You know, I really mean it as a metaphor, not an exact.
And we are members of no house here.
Right,
we are the
right,
peasantry.
We are the peasantry, right? We are collateral damage. I mean, dropping Google Reader is collateral damage. The fact that I can't get the maps on my iPad is collateral damage. And if you read about historical feudalism, it ended with the rise of the nation state, with things like the Magna Carta. And what basically happened is a larger government said to the feudal lords, look, you have all of these rights, you now have to have responsibilities. That having just one is, you know, is fun for you guys, but no fun for everybody else. And I want that metaphor to guide what we need to do on the internet.
So what's the Peace of Westphalia here?
I'm not that detailed. What I think we need
I was just thinking the next book is Westphalia. It's not just for ham.
Yeah, you know, but nobody would buy that.
Or the people would buy it expecting something very different.
You know, I think we need to recognize that these corporations are de facto states.
Which now sounds like Mark Zuckerberg on at least one day he woke up and decided that was an interesting thing to say. I don't know how much he stands behind it.
I know, but I want to regulate him. So yes. He's not going to like where I'm going.
Yes.
Right? And that we need to rein them in. That you know, on the internet there's no such thing as a public space. It's all
yes.
privately owned. But we treat these spaces as
yes.
public. We treat these as infrastructure, not as corporations. And it's more obscured by the fact that the basic market model, which is I buy something from you, you sell it to me, and we have this capitalistic change that really is the base of the system, fails because we are not customers of these things we use. Right? We are users, we are product, whatever you want to call us. So a lot of this is obscured.
So we're laying down markers here. As we're laying down this marker that's roughly, by your label, in the realm of digital feudalism, let me just mention the kinds of pushback that come to this kind of argument that I'm well familiar with since I argued similar things without the same terminology in my work.
It's the bumper sticker.
It is. And it's also a form of futileism, so it has a nice double entendre going on, which you appear to need for almost any book cover. Don't blame me. But the pushback includes, and I'll channel folks like the Mercatus Center or, mm-hmm. you know, name your favorite libertarian. The first objection to that is, give me a break, you're a communist. All right, get past that. Second is, we have more technological affordances today than we had yesterday, than we had last year. Isn't most of your worry front-loaded to some future that hasn't at least arrived yet? So there is a quality of Chicken Little, because I know I can't get Google Maps on my incredible iPad mini that didn't exist 3 years ago. Talk about the glass being 1 millionth empty.
Sure, but it's a lot more than that. You know, we know that Google collects this data. I mean, I'm worried a lot about government corporate interaction. We know that Google collects this data, and we know that the government asks them for it. I read an article. I've been talking about I guess the crazy libertarians about on the gun control.
You said crazy.
I will say it again, and I will endeavor to prove it if I have to. that the reason we oppose registering gun owners is because there'll be lists of gun owners the government used to confiscate guns. Right? That's the argument. I'm reading this, I'm thinking, why does the government need to get a list? What if they just asked Google? What if they just asked Axicom? And I think we're seeing more. Remember when...
How does Google know how many gun owners there are?
I'm sure in Google's data, if you ask Google who owns guns, I'm sure they'd give you a decent list.
Really?
Based on search terms, based on topics discussed, based on purchasing history. I mean, it depends who you ask. The question is, and if not now, when will it happen? I bet it's soon. When will the corporate sphere, just in the data they're collecting about our actions, have that list? Right, we know that the TSA, when they were trying to do secure flight, what it was called in like 05 and 06, they wanted to use corporate data to differentially screen passengers. Right? They recognized that data that we are willingly giving these companies, they could use for differential law enforcement in this case. And I wonder if the era of the government needs to know data from us is ending. I can imagine the IRS saying, you know, it's hard to figure out who to audit. We're going to go to a credit bureau. We're going to ask them to run a differential based on what they think your income is, or what you said your income is, and we're going to audit people who mismatch.
This is a good idea or a bad idea?
It might be an effective idea. I don't think it's a good idea. I mean. So, but it's an idea that we should discuss the possibility of before they go decide to do it without telling us.
Yes. Okay, but now...
So getting to sort of the question that, I mean, things are looking really good. Why are we worried? You know, we're at a point, and a lot of that is the opt-out answer. You don't like it, don't do it. Don't carry it. But that's not really possible. I mean, you can't not have a credit card. You actually really can't not have a cell phone.
Can you not have an iPad?
You could not have an iPad, but your choices are few, and if the two choices don't compete on the feature you're pissed about, you're stuck. I mean, you can't fly, you know, more secure airways, you run a background check on everybody, or less secure airways, we, you know, hand you a knife when you get on board. I mean, you don't have that ability. Right, all cell phone plans are...
The market has not spoken.
or at least the few sellers in the market have decided not to speak on that issue.
And right? It might just be some one-time flyers.
I mean, there isn't a Facebook that won't collect your data.
Which is an interesting puzzle, by the way. Why? Maybe we should just do a quick market test, although there's obviously selection bias in who chose to come tonight. But... How many people are Facebook users? All right, let the record show a lot. How many people are a little queasy about Facebook? The record shows more. And how many people would be okay with paying $5 a month and in exchange, Facebook will do zip with any data it collects? It expunges it as it has it and offers you $6. We're going to run an auction now. Just $5 how many people would pay $5? Now, why is that? Okay. All right, first of all, maybe 20% of the hands went up.
Because you asked the question wrong.
Oh,
the question
please.
Is, how many of you are willing to pay $5 to be in a non-intrusive Facebook when all of your other friends are on Facebook? That's the problem. It's the network effect. If you're not on Facebook, you don't get invited to parties, you don't get dates, you don't get laid.
But these folks are on Facebook, and they're not wanting to pay the $5, whether they're on it because they feel they have to be on it or they're on it because they like it. Either way, they're not willing to pay the $5 for the most part.
Sure, and some are and some aren't. I mean, the problem, and the problem we have with a lot of these systems, is they accrete. You know, we're on Facebook. I happen not to me, but I'm the Eudora using freak.
Wait, who am I friends with then? He looks like you.
Honestly, I get...
It's going to turn out to be Chuck Norris.
I get email from people thanking me for friending them on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter, so I don't know who you're friends with.
This does seem poor security, doesn't it? It opens the world to spoofing.
It's only so much I can do.
But now, this leads to the other, I think, main objection, although we may hear more shortly, on this riff of... Mark doesn't like what I have to say because I say I want to regulate them. A big part of your objection to these loci of concentrations of data is that it's very easy for the government to get it, and yet here you are saying, let's have the government come in and regulate these guys. When's the last time the government came in this space and did something you thought improved the situation?
In this space, but I mean, you have to take a long-term view, right? I mean, this is the only quote
that... We shouldn't tell the senators it's a bill about the internet until the very end.
Longer term. The quote that lets me survive in this world is Martin Luther King, "The arc of history is long but bends towards justice." Right? I mean, 100 years ago, half of us in this room couldn't vote. Right? 200 years ago, a bunch of us were slaves. I mean, in the long term, assuming my dystopian vision doesn't happen, governments will do the right thing.
How long do we have to wait to do the Facebook regulation you want
to
do?
You might have to wait 20 years. You might have to wait a generation. You might
really?
Have to wait 2 years.
Yep. So we haven't even regulated Friendster yet, but it's like, let's keep on. Let's see how this thing shakes out.
Short term, I'm actually very pessimistic. I mean, I don't think government can pass a good law at this point.
So you're testify, Mr. Schneier, should we get into the business of protecting the defenseless American public from these economic engines called Facebook and Google and everything? Should we get into this, or should we just keep on walking for 20 years? What's your answer?
You guys, you money-grubbing senatorial morons, you shouldn't do anything.
Definitely not confirmable.
Right? I mean, we're living in a world with a very dysfunctional government. And this is another one of my threats, that power is now using itself to increase power. So while in the near term I have actually no hope for... I think the update of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act would be a disaster because I can't imagine them making it better. I'd love them to make it better, but I can't imagine it happening. I'm terrified that they'll get their hands
on
it.
But if that's the case, I just want to pin you down for a moment here.
I'm slippery.
I know it. So you have a theoretical answer that says there ought to be some regulatory muscle that could be, but not always is, flexed, that answers to something other than a market, that answers to a polity, to deal with certain market failures you've identified. But in the real world, at least for the next 19 and a half years...
You ain't going to see it.
Or it's going to kick in the wrong direction.
Probably.
In which case, what should we do right now?
I don't know. I don't know if there's an answer. In a lot of ways, you're screwed. What do we do? What do we do in the face of a government, a U.S. government, that doesn't even follow its own law?
Yes.
With respect to data collection, data retention, and data use, that carves exceptions into its laws, right? We've learned recently that the FBI has been, for the past, over the decade, running fake cell towers for surveillance, almost certainly against law, right? I mean, NSA is eavesdropping. We're pretty sure that the DHS has collected the financial records of everybody under a national security letter. I mean, these things that are happening are I'm sense pretty abhorrent. And on the other hand, what we can do is keep fighting. Last week, and I've said this to a few people I've talked to. I don't know if people read Glenn Greenwald. He wrote a really nice essay on gay marriage where he said, it was one of the most uplifting things I've read in years. He said, look at what's gone on. We have for years been fighting an issue that we had no hope of winning. And in the space of 3 months, what the hell happened? It all turned around. Whereas now it seems that winning is inevitable. Look, don't give up, which was his moral. Which is more general, that his moral was that about that and Guantanamo and all the other things he argues about. I don't know. I have to believe that sooner or later.
Yes.
And we've got people working. Well, once Larry Lessig solves the money problem, I'm in. So I'm just counting on him to be like a month ahead with the solution.
Yes.
And as long as that happens,
yes,
we're good.
Internet, ?? Lessig, profit. Got it. Somebody needs to alert him, but this is progress. Now, you mentioned Glenn Greenwald. That's not a bad segue, because Glenn was one of the people who had been identified as an ally of sorts.
Conspirator, ally.
To WikiLeaks, yeah. to something. And Anonymous, in turn, managed to hack HB Gary Federal, mm-hmm. one of the be afraid, be very afraid, write us a check, profit, no question mark there. And Anonymous was able to completely own them, get all of their internal corporate email, including PowerPoint decks where they made their sales pitches to the likes of Bank of America, and where they proposed a dirty tricks campaign against Glenn Greenwald.
And others, but yes.
And
yeah,
others.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious. I'm curious. I know that you have thoughts about leaks and their value in a society, but I'm curious to really think about the function of something like Anonymous. It feels like a powerful entity that has the feature of not being harnessed to
right.
the traditional forces that may be not great, but it's also not harnessed to anything. How do you think about that?
There's a lot to be said about non-state actors. I mean, there's a lot to be said about that whole escapade. It's you know, we're living in a world where a bunch of hackers can, you know, drop a company. And later than a few months later, and this made the news less, Anonymous told NATO not to mess with it. We're living in a world where a bunch of guys can threaten NATO.
I thought
that's kind of freaky.
See, it's interesting, because they've also, I think, weighed in against North Korea, saying your time has come.
I
thought you were going to bring up that Anonymous had a war within itself. And there was a moment, if you went to one of Anonymous's main pages, it said, there's a guy who used to be us who compromised our server. Until further notice, don't visit our website anymore. You might get owned. And at that point, I was just like, you know, the center cannot hold.
Yeah, well,
I don't know who the Falcon and the Falconer is.
Anonymous is like a lot of movements that are given. You know, we as a species like organization, so we tend to assume our enemies organized. Reminds me of the way the Black Panthers were treated in the 60s. The way Al-Qaeda was treated 10 years ago, that we assumed it was this organization, you know, with roles and hierarchies and an org chart, and you drew a salary and got benefits. But in all those cases, it tends to be random people who pick up the banner and say, I'm Al-Qaeda, I'm Anonymous, I'm this. And maybe they're loosely connected, maybe they're ideologically connected, maybe they're just using the name. And it's a lot more diffuse. So you know, there really isn't an Anonymous. There are the people who today have done things and said, hey, look, we're Anonymous.
And what's your thinking around that phenomenon?
I think the rise of non-state actors is really interesting, that they can do real damage. I mean, it's this will be called the next cyber war, but, you know, it's not. It's a bunch of guys. Another thought that came out of my head. So the non-state actors, it's their power. Not being tied to a population makes them much more random. And I lost it. Oh, well. It'll come back.
I'll share some of my thinking about it, which is there's a paper that talks about an arrangement reached in the American antebellum North and South between political elites about a very contentious issue at the time, the return of fugitive slaves. And the North agreed to return fugitive slaves in order to keep the larger peace.
Right.
And it turned out that the North couldn't deliver because there wasn't professionalized law enforcement the way there is today. And in order to get pretty much anything done in a law enforcement context, like return a fugitive slave, you had to convene a posse, which was to say you had to ask the citizenry to come help, and the citizenry was going to be shampooing their cat that day. Like, they were not interested in doing that. And it was an interesting way of applying a template that perhaps subsists or persists only now in the tradition of the jury, where before you can just put somebody away, you get 12 citizens, good and true, or however many, and have them be the last ones to weigh in on this. And that is less and less needed as enforcement becomes more push button. We see it with anything ranging from YouTube takedowns to surveillance to et cetera. You don't need the posse anymore. And I'm wondering, is the rise of something like Anonymous and many counterparts a reintroduction of actually having to get a good portion of the polity in line with something for it to actually happen in the world? Well, or is it something else?
You know, I think that they are one of the first examples that we've seen of what civil disobedience looks like in the internet age. You know, what it means to protest, what a sit-in looks like, what a picket line looks like, what.
And do you have a view, by the way, on DDoS? Is it sit-in and should be treated as such, as Stallman would say, or is it blocking information?
But remember what I said in the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be you can tell by the weaponry. Now you can't. So a DDoS is either it's been used for extortion. Tends to happen most on fringe industries offshore, online gambling, online gaming, online porn. There is DDoS extortion. It is used for causing damage. It is used as protest. It is used because school's out and we're bored. So it's used for all of these things. Actually, there are cases a few years ago. The Victoria's Secret website went down, not because of a DDoS attack, but because of a lot of people wanted to see the pictures, but you couldn't tell the difference.
Not exactly this just in.
Right, but you can't tell the difference. If you were on the receiving end, you can't tell the difference. So Anonymous largely, I believe, engaged in legitimate civil disobedience and should be treated that way. Hmm. Not because of, less because of what they did and because of who they are and why they did it. Hmm. So, and I mean, this is hard. In the real world, we tend to have not different laws, but different expectations around civil disobedience. So you know that you'll get arrested and you may spend a few hours in jail, and this is all part of what we do.
But of course, Anonymous, if it's true to its name, wants the impact of civil disobedience without the part of civil disobedience where you go to jail. Now, in fairness, going to jail for 40 years for something wasn't in the cards at a counter sit-in.
Right,
before.
Because in the U.S. at least, we are, and I think we're doing this because of corporate pressure, classifying all of this as, you know, these horrible crimes against the internet, and we are really exaggerating what these are. So, I mean, I would want to remain anonymous, too. We really don't have an agreement among all of us of what valid protest is. I mean, defacing a website, right, could easily be, you know, I mean, you remember Greenpeace and they throw a banner on a smokestack. I mean, that's the equivalent of defacing a website. You make a public statement that those who are, or it's a picket line, you make a statement that those who are going to where, whatever it is you're protesting have to see it, have to interact with it. You know, but if you do it on the net, you are a cyber criminal and you get a really exaggerated sentence. I mean, bunches of examples.
And if your view, though, I just want to dwell on this for one moment. If somebody manages online to disrupt things, not just in a expressive kind of way. Vandalism is almost mm-hmm. the easiest case for online protest. It's the graffiti kind of.
Right.
But manages to do so in a way that, you know, PayPal or MasterCard, not just the brochure front page, but the actual functionality. The APIs aren't working for a while and a bunch of commerce grinds to a halt. You're saying, in your view, the motive of such an attack would be material to you in wanting to figure out how to treat it.
That feels in line with the way law works. I mean, we do look at motive. You know, uh-huh. accidental homicide versus murder.
Well, in this case, it's intentional homicide, but one was for a cause and the other was for money.
Okay, so it's less... Hmm? Sorry?
That's what we call war, intentional homicide.
Indeed. Right, I mean, so I think motive actually does matter. I mean, I think it matters in all crimes. Hmm. I mean, I've always wondered why you can be tried for murder over here with these horrible penalties and attempted murder over here with much fewer penalties based on, like, something as weird as how good your aim is. I mean, does that make any sense to... I mean, it makes no sense to me. It seems like if that's what you wanted to do, why should, like, or maybe how much the wind was blowing, or how lucky, you know, I mean, why should your penalty be based on factors that have nothing to do with intent? Hmm. Now, I'm not an attorney, so there's probably good reasons, because, I mean, certainly it's easier to measure the effects than the intent, right? So, I mean, my guess is that as we invent law, we could do the hard thing, but it's way easier to do the easy thing and just hope
it
basically sends it for...
It's funny that it puzzles you on the negative. I wonder how much it puzzles you on the positive. Should we give a Nobel Prize for an effort? Like, phlogiston, I'm sorry it didn't pan out, but there was a lot of work that went into it. That was pretty genius. It just wasn't true.
But there's a difference there, because there you actually are awarding a result. Right? You're not awarding... You're not passing. I mean, you can give.
It would be funny if somebody accidentally cured cancer and won the Nobel Prize, and the speech was just like, "It can happen to you too."
This will be like the Beverly Hillbillies of science.
Yes, that's right. Black DNA gold.
That would make a great
Caltech tea.
That would make a great sitcom, because now he's faculty at Harvard, right, and doesn't know a thing, and he's now got to teach and. Wow.
A less unusual situation than you would think. But, I feel like we should open it up. And to do so, and it's being recorded, I think, it's not going live, but it will be produced at your hearing. we should see, is there at least one handheld, so that there won't be the annoying phenomenon of questions are asked, but the multitudes who watch it later don't. So let's just let these handhelds find repose. And I guess my only suggestion, aside from the usual try not to speak unduly long, is I'm happy to try to engender a conversation more than a ping pong back and forth. So we'll weigh in when we're moved, but let's have a conversation. So here's a hand, here are mics. And also feel free to say who you are.
Or not, because it's being recorded.
Okay. Hi, Daniel Dern. I see enough scenarios here that we don't have the week to talk about it. But on one hand, you know, Bruce, you go to a restaurant, you get ready to, your hamburger comes, and then the guy at the register says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Schneier, but the restaurant computer refuses to sell you another hamburger this week because because your medical records say that's all you're allowed until next Thursday." On the other hand, somewhere in the basement of the FBI, there's a big master switch that says, "All cars except ours stop. You know, cruise to a safe stop and don't move." Or even
which is the more terrifying scenario?
Right. Or even United, or even the government says, "All network routing devices must use our code."
Sure.
You know, et cetera, and we're not telling you what's in it.
Like China is trying to do. I mean, right? So, that's not even theoretical. So I have to choose?
I'm not sure. It's the scenarios. Which is the most terrifying?
And I got to say, Bruce does run a semi-annual movie plot contest.
It's true.
So you're already, you got two entries going there. And as I understand the rules, it's to come up with as scary and yet realistic a plot as possible, but one for which there's no cognizable specific policy that the government could do that it was would be a response.
So the phrase "movie plot threat" I coined to be, and you see these overly specific scare stories you'll hear in an effort to make you afraid. That you
sound like a great Showtime series. Overly specific scare stories.
Well, but you remember them. Remember the terrorists with scuba gear, the terrorists with almanacs. I mean, all of those sorts of, they make great movie plots, but you don't want to craft policy around them, yet those are... And when I first did the contest, I got email from saying, "Oh, my God, how could you give the terrorists ideas?" Like, people actually thought that the hard part of terrorism was the idea. That once you told them, "Look, you can bomb a dam," they'd say, "God, why didn't I think of that?" and run off and do it.
So just on that one point for a moment, there is... I don't know how many people remember this, but back in the day, there was that movie Independence Day.
They're making a sequel. They're making a sequel.
Arbor Day. They're just going down the whole federal holiday calendar. And the British internationalized counterpart, Bank Holiday. Bank Holiday 2. Anyhow, I'm now confusing myself with what my question was. Independence Day, the trailer came out, and that trailer featured the White House being blown to bits. And I don't know how many people happen to have remembered being in the theater the first time you saw that trailer. I at least remember feeling like, whoa, that was intense. And the reaction of the rest of the theater was kind of a stunned silence.
Wow.
Even though there have been plenty of B-movies that show Godzilla tearing cities apart. And even within the cycle of that trailer, by the time it was getting stale, people were laughing at it. And of course now, I think there are two movies being released this week, which is like, the White House blows up even more. And there is maybe something, I wonder, about making certain things more thinkable, not by a contest,
right,
not on a blog, but by making mainstream certain acts.
I think so. I want to address the
original
the hamburger.
Yes.
I mean, basically, what we're saying is, do we want the government to regulate our choices? That's the question. And we do all the time. Right? The pharmaceuticals you can buy, that hamburger, you know, can't have more than... There's some amount of bug parts that are allowed and some that are too much. It's not...
on the selling side, as I was saying, you cannot sell raw milk.
Right. Yeah, okay.
Seems
okay.
Awfully hard to buy it if people can't it. But
okay, I'm not sure there's there might be. I mean, okay, yeah. Then take drugs on the prescription side. You know, some people can buy this pharmaceutical, the rest of us can't because there's a mechanism by which you can get it. We as society, I mean, there's a long riff here. I think you can make a reasonable argument that modern advertising is an unfair trade practice. That it is no longer a seller informing a potential buyer of the virtues of his product, and it's now deliberate psychological manipulation.
I can't think of any other reason I'm buying most of the stuff I buy. So working backwards, I can't be to blame.
So, I mean, along with my riff on libertarianism is completely wrong, is the notion that, and there's a lot of psychological studies to back this up, that the point of sale is a terrible place to gauge preferences, that you know, that on the long term people want to eat better. On the short term, man, that hamburger looks good. I mean, I ate one of those damn Chex Mix bags when I came in here. You know, I would have been way happier.
This session
exist.
Sponsored by Chex.
Right, I would have been way happy. I mean, this is why we've adopted term limits. Right, please pass a law to prevent me from exercising my preferences. Right,
but
that
Bruce,
is a truly wacky thing.
Let me interject right here, because this so nicely fits into your earlier riff about Facebook and Google are kind of, you can't just say it's market, they're kind of
right.
Have an advantage, and that's why government should come in. So the analogy here would be, one reason they might not sell you the hamburger is because you signed up ahead of time and said, no matter what I do,
right,
don't sell the
right,
Ulysses
please stop me.
Thing.
Yeah, you're here.
The other reason might be some Bloombergian, Sunsteinian nudge or something, where they are actually doing their best to remind you of the kind of commitments you want, or the burgers have to be served with blue buns and they may get less esculent that way, whatever it is.
But
that's an example of the government intervening to save us from the market.
Right. Because
Who's worse in this circumstance, Bloomberg or Big Gulp?
Well, these manipulations are happening. I mean, in your grocery store, products are paying for eye-level placement. Ones that don't pay get high or low. Those big gulps were designed for you to...
So if the government intervenes to somehow...
Someone's intervening. I mean,
yes.
Intervention is happening. We can either say no intervention, which maybe we can do, or we can try... I mean, and this is where I have trouble with solutions, but my guess is that solutions will be the multiple distrustful parties each keeping the other in check. So do we want government intervention to limit corporate intervention? I mean, I think some solution will have a corporate component, a government component, an NGO component, that everybody will be sort of keeping an eye on everybody else. Of course, this could fail. I mean, I thought this is the way the U.S. government was supposed to work, but
yeah.
Post-9/11, everybody fell down on the job, right? The Congress wouldn't keep the president in check. The court said, I don't need you to keep me out of this. But in theory, that's the sort of system I want to work.
Well, at the very least, it means one can retreat to. We really need a self-conscious dialogue about what kinds of forces. We, it's something.
I'm a big fan of the Sustine nudges, because the
even though they are manipulation,
but the manipulation is happening anyway. I mean, this is my unfair trade practices argument that we're being manipulated for profit. Maybe it's not that bad to be manipulated for benevolence.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, of course, who decides what benevolence is? I mean, there's a lot of devil in the details. But there's a whole lot of devil if you don't do these details.
Yes. Well, as was promised, this is a week's worth of stuff. Is there anything you want to say about the FBI turning off all our cars? Which, when I put it that way, makes it sound absurd. But in fact, the more devices are tethered, the more a government can ask. Do you want to say something about that before we
And we've seen requests for that. You know, in the event of a terrorist emergency, can the government shut off the internet? I mean, this is being asked.
Yeah.
I mean, cars is going to be driverless cars, high-speed chase. We need the ability to turn off cars on this highway for the safety of everybody. I mean, you can see how
that could make sense,
right?
Because
or at least how that would be requested.
Yeah.
But internet kill switch has been debated. I mean, to me, that's fundamentally crazy for a whole lot of other reasons. You know,
I should say, in fairness, that at the time it was debated, the senators pushing the bill that was said to contain it said, this bill doesn't contain that. In fact, the government has long since had that authority since amendments to the Communications Act made in the wake of Pearl Harbor. So there is, I think,
The internet provision that was passed in the 40s.
So we should keep the conversation going. Have the mics found another home? How about over here?
Got someone there.
So this is not my opinion in particular, but I've been exposed to the opinion by people in this computer security community that the way in which to deal with these sorts of problems is that that everybody should be responsible for their own information technology security, that everybody should learn the skill set in full, and that if you don't learn the skill set, that it's your own problem.
Dan Geer is one of the people who's talked about an internet driver's license.
The problem is it's actually not only your problem. You know, we are too interconnected. I mean, if you think of DDoS attacks and bots, your security is very directly a function of whether my mother remembers to turn her firewall back on. Because if she doesn't, there are more insecure computers being used for more things.
But I guess one question is, how much low-hanging fruit is there in trying to get grandma to turn on the firewall? Of all the things that make security hard, is there some space comparatively to make user education?
I'm not a big fan of user education. I think user education is a cop-out. I think user education is a cop-out when computer security people like me design crap systems. I mean, you get these warnings, right? You see them on your computer. Complex security thing, blah, 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 blah. Do you want to continue? Yes, no. And what you read is, blah, 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 blah. Make this dialog box go away. Right? That's what you read. And you click.
Would you like to continue with what you're doing?
Right.
Okay or cancel.
Would you like me to stop annoying you? it is rare that the user can make a better decision.
I can't wait for the Firefox plugin called Yes Man that just answers all dialog boxes okay. I'm patenting that.
You know, so I want systems that are robust enough to deal with an uneducated user. I mean, we can't legitimately say you have to, you know, you need to pass a skill test to use the internet. It'll be real hard to turn it into something like driving a car. And I'm not sure we want
to. So right now, just share with us your best conception of the process of a user checking email from a server, whoever the provider might be. What would be the best practice using today's technology so that the email provider could make it as secure as possible without the user having to be anybody other than grandma?
You know, what we have today is mostly good. I mean, I like seeing the additional authentication mechanisms. I like seeing the backup authentication mechanisms improved. You know, it's not a lot.
So you don't see anything out there that isn't already kind of working its way in.
You know, and this is a surprise. This is a surprise really from your book. When I read your book, you made a really good point that openness is so much better, and that a closed system will be rejected. And I believe that too, and we got it wrong. People love the iPhone. And iPhone is a very close... iPhone is giving you more security because they regulate what goes on that platform. Right? And it turns out, much to my annoyance, that people like that. I mean, and this is the problem with the feudal metaphor. We like these feudal systems because my mother does a way better job with her photos on Flickr. It's really better for her to be on Gmail. It's better for her calendar and her dress book. She loses her phone, she gets a new one, pushes a button, it all appears magically. Right? For the average user, this feudal trade-off isn't that bad. I'd like it to be worse, but it turns out not to be. Right? Because the cost my mother is paying is largely invisible. It's largely long-term. Right?
And along solely the dimension of security against third-party attack, it may well be more secure for her.
Almost certainly is. But even against the thing I'm more worried about, the third-party attack is she making a mistake. Right? You know, you make a mistake and you lose your photos, you lose your email, your hard drive no longer works. It's robust against the naive user, which is really valuable.
Yes.
Because if we want an internet to be socially useful, it has to be technologically easy.
Yes. Ethan Zuckerman.
Hi. Guys, I wanted to return to this idea of the asymmetric attack and the notion that the bad guys get way ahead of the good guys and what this makes us think about open and closed environments. And Bruce, I was working on my entry for the movie plot, and I put together two current events. One current event was this strange little paper where someone claims that they infected 100,000 cable set-top boxes and used them to make a map of the internet. Hard to verify, but a fairly convincing paper suggesting that someone built a little worm that was capable of getting into many, 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 many set-top boxes. And roughly at the same time, a really big DDoS attack using DNS amplification, which we've all known about for a very long time, but swamping Spam House, our friends and sometimes enemies who try to knock out internet spam under 300 gigabits per second of traffic, a level that many of us thought was kind of unfeasible for those things. You put the two of those together, and you suddenly have a scenario in which everyone's cable box, compromised, becomes part of a giant DDoS network, hitting DNS and knocking out servers. And for the first time...
You have to have a broadcast fake news. Then you've got a really good James Bond plot.
As if that's not already happening.
For the first time...
People would not notice.
People might not notice. For the first time in all of this, I found myself sort of looking at this and going, maybe I'm actually scared about this. Maybe I've actually hit the point where these open systems that for years we've known are riddled with holes because we are idiots about security, but we are so resilient because we share information very quickly, we adapt, so on and so forth. I find myself wondering if we're hitting a point where not just on the consumer devices, where I think you're absolutely right, Bruce, that people in many cases are preferring the safer environments, whether we're going to hit this point on the actual core net. Do we think that we might be reaching a tipping point on this? Is that part of what's reflected in you writing something that's significantly depressing? And the follow-up to this is this going to shake Zittrain at all on this, who thus far has been really good about sort of coming back and saying, yeah, in general, we're willing to trade a lot to make sure that we have the openness out there, and so far it hasn't been this in the butt. Is this finally the time we get?
So I think that's a good example. So, and my worry is really that the fear of these things will lead the actuality. I mean, this whole weapons of mass destruction debate is largely a fear debate. The cyber war debate is largely a fear debate. These are not based on realistic threats. But, you know, that 10, 20, 30 years, they likely will be. I'm afraid you have a point.
I find myself wanting to say, especially when I ran into that Spam House situation, I find myself wanting to say, yes, this is exactly what I predicted. Because my book wasn't, things are great, except people are paranoid, and the paranoia is going to destroy us. That was not the theme. It was, things may be great now, but the better they get, the higher the stakes are for somebody to find value in making it worse. And unless we come up with a defense to it that is constructed along the lines of what made it great to begin with, namely a distributed civic defense for a distributed civic network, the most obvious defense when the trolls come is going to be a centralized response, a militarized response, and that's bad. So I think that fits the template in the sense of people are a little bit kind of asleep at the switch or a collective action problem. There ought to be ways, and there have been ways suggested to secure Border Gateway Protocol, to secure DNS service and DNS servers, because each of those cable boxes contains a DNS resolver. Who knew? That is a public proxy? Like, what? So these are the kinds of things that either might be so specific a movie plot that right. It's hard to go just closing doors after horses leave, but that actually had been long anticipated. And if the community that has roughly existed to build this distributed collective hallucination to begin with could come up with the distributed defense of it, so far the way Wikipedia has managed to do it, the content layer, a distributed content generation system that contains its own defense, not just against garden variety inaccuracy, but against every page being turned into an ad for a Rolex watch, which you can guarantee is being attempted as we speak, that gives me hope. I just worry yeah. that the paranoia generated by the very real dangers represented by that incident will have us just say, we've got to send the Marines somewhere.
And I agree with the paranoia worry. I mean, any solution is going to look like some form of resilience. And whether it's, I mean, the Wikipedia distributed type of resilience, whether it's something built into the internet, you know, there'll be different aspects of it. But in a world, I mean, we're seeing people today calling the cyber threat an existential threat to humanity. Those words are being used by actual policymakers. That is fundamentally a crazy thing to say. But, you know, getting past that is going to be a realization that, you know, 9/11, you know, the existential threat was not this terrorist attack, it was a reaction to it. That if we come from, not from fear, but from indomitability. I mean, imagine if that's what, you know, President Bush got up and said, yes, this is horrible, yes, we're going to be after them, yes, we're going to achieve justice, but our country is better than this. We're not going to, you know, the things they killed us for are not, we're not going to change because they tried. I mean, those sorts of ways, and I think that rhetoric makes a huge difference.
But see, up to the minute, Bruce Schneier, who worries about asymmetric offense, I'm and not, says we have an existential
you
threat.
You know, I mean, we said in the beginning this is not a consistent talk.
Yes. Well, it is and it isn't. Sorry.
It's my
cheap shot, I'm sorry. Other mics, yes, back here.
Hi, I'm Gilly. I'm a senior at the college here and a former Berkton. So it seemed that the most pragmatic solution we have come up with thus far is to start a discussion. So I want to ask about how to frame that discussion. I think that the role of metaphors has sort of come up here, and we talked about war as a metaphor, and it's sort of both a conflation of the threat and the use of notions from national security. And then another thing that Bruce seems to support to me is the public health metaphor, in a sense, you know, the Bloomberg intervention and the sort of making sure grandma turns on the firewall again. Are there any other metaphors we should be considering, and should we be aware of these metaphors and what they imply? And how
I mean, I think the metaphors are extraordinarily important. I mean, just taking the cyber war metaphor, when you use the word war, you invoke a certain solution space, right? Right? Certain things that wouldn't be considered are reasonable when you're at war. For these type of cyber attacks, I much prefer a police metaphor. And actually, for terrorism, I much prefer a police metaphor. And I think it's more accurate, and I think that we as a people would make better trade-offs, right? You know, when it's war, when the NSA goes to you and says, you know, can I eavesdrop on every phone call? Right, you don't say, where's your warrant? You say, okay, you know, put the stuff in the closet over there, don't tell anybody. And that's because your thinking is war. So, you know, I find the war metaphor dangerous. I like a public, I think a public health model, I think biological metaphors are, in general, useful for the internet. That there's a lot of analog, I mean, not the least of is viruses. And it's funny, we're starting to see that go back. We're starting to see the term virus came from health. We're starting to see these ways that we're thinking about computer viruses going back into the medical community. And they're using some of the tools we've developed for computer viruses to look at the spread of actual biological viruses. Right, the metaphor of how the internet stateless versus stateful, not from a finite state, but from a government perspective. I mean, the metaphor of the 90s, remember the internet is outside of any nation state, right, is turning out to be not true at all. And there's more censorship than ever, and now there's a rise in that is called the cyber sovereignty movement, which would terrify all of us. Right, where countries are saying, look, you know, every piece of the internet is in somebody's border, and the ones that are in my border, I get to control. Right, and this is the ITU getting involved. A lot of this, I think you fight on the level of metaphor. You get the right metaphor. Magical things happen. It really frames the debate. These debates are hard, they're technical, they're confusing, and the metaphors matter an enormous amount.
For what it's worth, the metaphor I'm most intrigued by these days is mutual aid. And if I'm in a military environment, I'll call it a NATO for cyberspace. But elsewhere, it's mutual aid that tries to push against the idea of, I wrote my check, give me internet, and if there's a problem with it, it's a customer service issue, that a lot of what built it was a form of mutuality, and there may be useful ways for people to be able to help one another with cycles and bandwidth, with expertise, and even at the content layer, in times of real crisis. That is it a good thing to imagine, should something happen, natural disaster or otherwise, my 3G goes down, my Wi-Fi isn't going anywhere, I'm stuck. But what if my phone were a two-way radio that could talk to every other two-way radio in the room? And what if my Facebook credentials were cached and I could then say, are any of my Facebook friends in this ad hoc network? And if they are, I'd like to send them a message. And is there anybody on the network that has a pre-cached root certificate that says, I'm from the government and I'm here to help because I'd like some help? Those are examples to me of mutual aid in action. It's not a solution to every problem, but it tends to be overlooked, right, because it isn't all that helpful in many other public safety defense operations that the other metaphors tend to invoke.
Yeah, I tend to like infrastructure metaphors. Yeah, but Sun had the idea of the internet dial tone. I kind of like that. And I think there's something to be said for starting to realize that the internet is infrastructure, is a utility, is not optional. It's like water, it's like power. I think that's valuable. I mean, British Telecom had a great slogan a couple of years ago called innovation at the speed of life. Now, they meant it to mean going really fast. And I thought of it and said, wouldn't it be neat to have it slow down like that?
I'm thinking about the cereal. Okay, so why don't we take a few more questions? We only have 14 minutes left.
Wow.
So my suggestion is that we take some thoughts, and they're going to pile up and be specific, but Bruce has a pen. He's going to write some stuff down. I just want to get some more voices in as we go, so please.
So I'm less concerned about threats from the internet to humans, but threats from humans to the internet. And if you look at World War II or World War I, where you had a global scale conflict, you saw letters sort of being smuggled across borders, and there some communication was possible, but it was extremely limited. I'm curious what if the internet can exist post a global scale conflict where nations are rebuilding their networks, and whether the internet can exist during a global scale conflict, and what your thoughts on that are.
Uh-huh. Let's take some other questions wherever the mics happen to be. This may, I realize, favor people on the periphery, but yes?
Eric, I'm a 2L law student. So you mentioned that, speaking about Anonymous, that we're going to call it the next cyber war, but it's not. It's just a bunch of random guys. And yet your emphasis on the asymmetry of attack and defense seems to run against the idea that war can't be about random guys. And I'd just like some comments on that.
Got it. I was going to ask you about government policy, too, but we'll let you succeed. Where's the other mic? Yep.
I was going to suggest that the reason you got a tepid response to would you pay $60 for a less data-collecting Facebook is that it would be a less useful Facebook. You would be losing all of the people who like X also like Y suggestions that people tend to actually like getting.
Facebook comes back and says, for you, we'll still keep that for your $5. Would that get your hand up?
But it,
in other words, you think what you hate is also what you like.
In general, people tend to like the primary uses. Everyone likes Amazon suggesting books they like based on books they bought. What people tend to dislike are the secondary uses, that Amazon then sells that data to somebody else and it propagates out. We tend to be okay with the immediate recommender systems and the immediate systems.
Although it is interesting to imagine those applied to people suggesting, well, people who like this will like this other person, right, especially in a real environment rather than just Facebook. And that is, yeah, getting really close.
People who attended this lecture might like to attend the lecture next week.
Yeah. Where are the other mics? Are they, yep.
On the subject of Anonymous, I'm just wondering how much you think Anonymous is sort of a reaction to a loss of faith in the government. For example, with WikiLeaks, people who supported WikiLeaks didn't have really a standard way of aiding within the system. It wasn't like the FBI was standing up and saying, well, WikiLeaks may or may not be legal, but we're going to hunt down these people who are doing DDoS on WikiLeaks. So Anonymous is sort of people who said, well, our only option is to go DDoS other people, and then we can sort of defend WikiLeaks.
I guess this is the
way.
Batman theory of, yes, the Times call for the person. Is the other mic floating around somewhere? Oh, right there. Sorry.
Yeah, to go back to the feudal metaphor, my name's Hal Hodson. To go back to the feudal metaphor briefly, I guess the feudal system became bad when people started getting hurt, and you could kind of imagine that at the beginning it was rather nice. Kind of like at the beginning.
Episode one.
Yeah, and you can kind of imagine at the beginning Google was rather nice, and it was. Oh. So what's the internet company equivalent of, you know, killing peasants because you don't, because you're pissed off? Like, what's going to happen? What are the damage equivalents for internet companies of the feudal
problem? I think
the
loss of Google Reader is the one we got right now.
Google Reader is hardly, you know, killing villagers. What's going to hurt me? Google Reader is just inconvenient. What's actually going to harm me?
I don't think
you took away my free product. How dare you?
I don't think you
Ben and Jerry's. I want ice cream every day.
I don't think you get that kind of harm. I mean, it is the internet. I mean, it's not the real world. So you're not going to get Facebook.
As Captain Kirk would say, for how long, Mr. Schneier? For how long?
You're not going to get Facebook spearing its users. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Well, there's at least a silver lining to his pessimism. Now, I know we've piled up a lot of questions. Is there anything you wanted to say on what's happened so far before we open it up again?
Well, I mean, the question I thought was the notion of you know, can a bunch of guys declare war? They can do something, but I think, you know, war is a very specific thing, and it's something nation states do. I argue that what a bunch of guys do, even if it's damaging, and there's a lot of history, but organized crime can do a lot of damage. A couple of weeks ago, had someone assassinate a prosecutor in Texas. And then last week, and I think this is very much, I don't know if it's terrorism, I don't know what to call it, but a couple of days ago, another prosecutor has stepped off a case prosecuting the Aryan Brotherhood because he fears for his life. I mean, this is a violent action to change policy. So, you know, I'm not sure what to call it. But, you know, these things, even though they're bad, even though they kill people, they're not war. And war to me is nation state versus nation state. And yes, there are these new sorts of asymmetric threats, and they are important, but is the war metaphor the proper way to deal with it? I mean, and we screwed this up, right? We were attacked in 9/11, and in response, we invaded a country. Because that's what militaries do. If the FBI were in charge, we wouldn't have invaded a country, because that's not what the FBI does. Now, we can argue whether invading the country was the right thing to do, but there was no actual debate about it, because the war metaphor was immediately invoked.
It is funny to think if the president, in the wake of 9/11, had said, we are starting a full criminal investigation, the U.S. attorney in the Southern District.
Which is what we did.
He would have been run out on a rail.
Which is what we did with every other terrorist attack to date.
Yes.
I mean, that's what we did after Mumbai. That's, I mean, not Mumbai, Kenya. Right.
But it is interesting to see
that's what happened
merely a decade later that choice, which may well have been sort of by democratic accountability a somewhat forced one to assign. That's no doubt debatable.
It was psychologically the right choice, unfortunately.
But it's interesting that choice then persists in the sense that attempts to downshift into a let's try these folks in the criminal system mode still results in a lot of pushback.
I mean, remember that we were trying to bring one terrorist from Guantanamo to New York to try him, and right, there was actual fear we couldn't put him in a U.S. jail. And I'm thinking, what is he, Magneto? I mean, he's, right? He's just a guy.
Yeah.
But there is this fear. I think Obama had the opportunity to change it.
Yeah.
When he took office, he could have said, and it's a perfectly reasonable reaction that when you're
actually the Congress actually passed a statute,
yes,
it's
preventing
part of the
him.
Authorization Act that prevented it. Yeah. Yeah. There was one other quick thought, too, on your notion about when you have prosecutors withdrawing from cases out of fear for their physical safety.
That's what happened in the U.S.
Right. Right?
That happens in other countries.
Or other countries
not
where
States.
You have judges wearing hoods.
Right.
Or that kind
or,
of
I mean,
thing.
That happens in Mexico. That doesn't happen
but
in
But it
the
gets
US.
Back to the question of if our own primary institutions are faltering, does that push for alternatives? And to me, it calls to mind a book to be published by Yale University Press called The Cartoons That Shook the World, a very scholarly treatment, peer-reviewed, of the Mohammed cartoons from Denmark. And it included not only the cartoons in question, but depictions of Mohammed over the centuries. And Yale University Press did a security review prior to going ahead to publication and concluded that it was not safe to publish, and insisted that all of the cartoons and all of the other depictions be removed from the book, and the book was still published over the objections of the author. It was removed. The book was published without them, and when Yale responded to assertions that they were kind of giving in to threats of violence kind of thing, they said, well, you know, you can just get to them on Wikipedia, so what did you need us for it? And it's an interesting kind of point that Wikipedia, there's not even enough of a there to decide whether to take the cartoons off, that they're a click away. And in fact, there is a discussion, a talk tab on the page about the cartoons on Wikipedia, talking about offending sensibilities, not threats of physical violence, and they decided it would be a very small thumbnail, and then you could click if you wanted. That was the Wikipedian's solution.
But
that, the problem.
I mean, that goes to his point of anonymous being a loss of
faith. That's what I mean.
A loss of faith. And I think if you sort of look at their activism, it is both a frustration at the institutions who are behaving badly and a belief that the institutions aren't going to follow through on what they should do.
So my guess is the mics are in two hands currently or about to be. Let's do those last two mics, and then we should wrap. Where are they? Right here, sir.
Adrian Gropper, you invoked Lessig and the gay marriage flip. And the question is, how optimistic can we be that the nation state becomes redefined by the Internet? in time to save us from this apocalypse?
That is the question. So the question really is the relative speed of social change, political change, and technological change. Right? That's your question. It's a really good one.
Detecting a theme in tonight's talk. Yes.
Hi, Pete Devlin. I was wondering whether, at least in some cases, we don't have to be so afraid that the government has access to our data. So we talked about them using our financial data to decide who to audit. And if they're mining through our data, everyone's anonymous as they're going through until you are identified as someone likely to have committed tax fraud. And whereas before the internet, they would have had to break into your house, look around, see if the pool's in the back or not. And that seems to me like a much more fundamental invasion of privacy than just seeing your anonymous data and then pulling out the committers.
And in a lot of cases, you can build privacy-preserving systems. Already we allow the police a remarkable level of intrusion into our lives. We do that willingly. But we put in a security mechanism. Right? The warrant process is meant to be a security mechanism. So I will allow the police to intrude in my life, but they have to first convince a neutral third party that it is in society's best interest to do so. There are rules about telling me they did it after the fact. There's a whole lot of mechanisms, not to limit what the police can do, but to limit how they can do it. And so that's our trade-off to make that work. Now, those sorts of trade-offs are certainly possible in all of these technological type of surveillances, investigations, data collections. We're not doing any of them. An example is in full body scanners at airports, right? That you can either see the picture or you can blur out the human form and see a stylized picture and just the contraband objects you're looking for. Right? You know, they're both technologically the same. Larry Lessig gives the great point of the license plate. Right, the police say, look, we need to know who's driving the cars because the cars are hitting things and killing people and driving away, and that sucks. Right, our idea, the police says, is to put everybody's name on the back of the car. Right, someone says, wait, don't do that. That loses anonymity. Put a random number on the back of the car. We will give you, the police, the database of random numbers attached to people, and that way you can look cars up when you need to. Right? That's a mechanism that gives the police what they wanted but preserves privacy. And there are a lot of really clever things we can do. To do that, we're just not doing them.
Which also tends to raise the question that often divides engineers and lawyers, and you kind of gave the lawyer's answer, descriptively speaking, which is, well, we can hash it, we'll have a table, and then the government can consult the table when it has good cause. And often the engineering answer is, I never trust them to have good cause. I want a fake license plate or no license plate or something like that.
There's an argument to be made that one of the solutions here to the very invasive police measures is to give the police better tools.
Yeah.
The reason, they're just trying to do their job in most cases.
Yeah.
And it's a job we want done. And the reason they have to be so expansive is we don't have the surgical tools. And if we could design them, we'll have a better chance of having them not do the things we don't want them to do.
So speaking of engineers and lawyers, this event is co-sponsored by the Center for Research on Computation and Society at the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society of Harvard University, but often identified with Harvard Law School. And I think tonight's conversation has been as kaleidoscopic and freewheeling as it was promised to be. And we're still trying to figure out how to make the most of a physical gathering like this, a gathering augmented by the various technologies we know are happening at the moment in the background. There could have been a big Twitter feed or something on the screen behind us. But these are threads of conversation, I think, that show first how hard this stuff is and not purporting to have answers where we don't yet have them, and that also really cause us, I think, to ask, how many of our solutions can be general-type solutions, a sort of approach that can work from zone to zone to zone, or how much of it is just trying to fix one leak at a time and do so in a way that may feel like your movie plot example, which is you just keep closing barn doors. But it provides, I think, a lot of puzzle that we continue to work on in venues very different from a public lecture. We're very hopeful that Bruce will continue to be in our environments here in Cambridge and virtually, and that we'll have a chance to continue the kinds of conversations that are happening here.
And I actually really appreciate the conversation. This is stuff I am, as you can tell, still trying to figure out. So I'm glad it's been taped because I wasn't taking notes, but I will listen to this again.
For that,
because I said stuff I didn't realize I was going to say.
And you realize there's a bunch of people tweeting stuff that you are friending you on Facebook now, and we have to tell them it ain't you.
Okay, there actually is a Facebook account that mirrors my blog, and there's a Twitter account that mirrors my blog. I control the Facebook account, but not the Twitter account. Someone else set that up. But I never actually visit these sites.
All right, then.
So don't send me stuff on Facebook.
So please join me in thanking Bruce Schneier for a very provocative 90 minutes.